Welcome to this week's Ortho Digest Rundown for June 29, 2026. This week we indexed 175 new orthopedic studies across 34 journals. The 75 highest impact studies are featured on the site, and we're covering the top 25 studies in this audio digest. As always, studies are ranked by our impact algorithm, which weighs journal tier and level of evidence. Let's start with our first study. Heapy and colleagues published in JAMA, titled Self-Directed versus Clinician-Delivered Cognitive Behavioral Therapy for Chronic Pain, a Randomized Clinical Trial. This pragmatic superiority randomized controlled trial across 9 VA systems compared self-directed CBT for chronic pain, an 11-week program with asynchronous coach feedback, versus clinician-delivered CBT for chronic pain delivered over 4 to 11 sessions, in 764 veterans with chronic musculoskeletal pain. At 4 months, self-directed CBT produced superior pain interference reduction on the brief pain inventory interference scale, with a mean difference of 0.98 points favoring self-directed treatment. This superiority was maintained at 6 and 12 months across all secondary outcomes, including pain intensity, catastrophizing, self-efficacy, sleep, and depressive symptoms. Session completion rates were also higher in the self-directed arm. One limitation to note is that the clinician-delivered arm reflected usual care practice with variable session dose, potentially underestimating the true efficacy of clinician-delivered CBT. Overall, self-directed CBT for chronic pain produced a mean 0.98-point greater reduction in brief pain inventory interference scores versus clinician-delivered CBT at 4 months, with superiority sustained through 12 months. Moving on, Shin and colleagues published in Spine Journal, titled 3D Printed Porous Titanium versus Polyether Ether Ketone Cages in Lumbar Interbody Fusion, a prospective, multicenter, randomized controlled trial with bone mineral density stratification. This multicenter randomized controlled trial compared 3D printed porous titanium versus PEEK cages in single-level lumbar interbody fusion, stratifying patients by preoperative bone mineral density. Overall fusion rates were equivalent, at 92.9% versus 92.6% per protocol. However, overall subsidence was significantly lower with 3D printed titanium at 7.1% versus 37.0% with PEEK. In the osteoporotic subgroup, the difference was even more striking. PEEK subsidence reached 58.3% compared to just 12.5% for 3D printed titanium, with corresponding inferior visual analog scale back pain and Oswestry Disability Index scores. One limitation to note is that the osteoporotic subgroup contained only 8 patients per arm. Overall, in osteoporotic patients undergoing single-level lumbar interbody fusion, 3D-printed porous titanium cages reduced subsidence rate from 58.3% to 12.5% compared to PEEK, with a T-score cutoff of negative 2.4, identifying patients at elevated PEEK subsidence risk. Moving on, Chen and colleagues published in Journal of Orthopedic Surgery and Research, titled Efficacy of Intraosseous Tranexamic Acid in Primary Total Hip Arthroplasty, a Prospective Randomized Controlled Trial. This 3-arm randomized controlled trial randomized 126 primary total hip arthroplasty patients to intraosseous, intravenous, or topical tranexamic acid, 20 mg per kilogram each, to test non-inferiority of intraosseous administration. The primary outcome, hemoglobin reduction from day of surgery through postoperative day 3, was statistically equivalent across all 3 groups. Exploratory analysis showed lower calculated total blood loss in the intraosseous group on the day of surgery and postoperative day 1. Transfusion rates were similar across groups, ranging from 2.3% to 7.1%, though the authors acknowledge uncertain clinical relevance of these differences. One limitation to note is that the study is underpowered for transfusion rate as an endpoint, and the 6-month enrollment window raises concerns about adequate follow-up for thromboembolic and infectious adverse events. Overall, intraosseous tranexamic acid at 20 mg per kilogram is non-inferior to intravenous and topical tranexamic acid for hemoglobin reduction across postoperative days 0 through 3. With exploratory data showing lower calculated total blood loss in the intraosseous group on the day of surgery and postoperative day 1. Moving on, Kalafala and colleagues published in Knee Surgery, Sports Traumatology, Arthroscopy, titled Quadriceps Tendon Autograft, provides comparable stability and functional outcomes with lower donor site morbidity than bone patellar tendon bone. A systematic review and meta-analysis of 15 randomized controlled trials with grade evidence. This Cochrane-guided systematic review and meta-analysis of 15 randomized controlled trials from 2014 to 2025 compared quadriceps tendon autograft to bone patellar tendon bone and hamstring autograft for primary anterior cruciate ligament reconstruction. KT1000 side-to-side difference, graft failure rates, and patient-reported outcomes, including the International Knee Documentation Committee score, Lysholm score, knee injury and osteoarthritis outcome score, and Tegner activity level, were statistically equivalent across comparisons at 12 to 24 months. Donor site morbidity was significantly lower with quadriceps tendon versus bone patellar tendon bone at high-grade certainty. A small 12-month knee injury and osteoarthritis outcome score signal favored quadriceps tendon over hamstring. But this difference was null at 24 months. One limitation to note is that follow-up is limited to 24 months across all included trials, which is insufficient to assess late re-rupture rates or progression to tibiofemoral osteoarthritis. Overall, quadriceps tendon autograft achieves equivalent KT1000 stability and International Knee Documentation Committee and Lysholm outcomes versus both bone patellar tendon bone and hamstring autograft at 12 to 24 months. With high certainty evidence of substantially lower donor site morbidity compared to bone patellar tendon bone across 15 randomized controlled trials. Moving on, Karaman and colleagues published in International Orthopedics, titled The Effect of J-Shaped Incision versus Standard Midline Incision on Numbness and Pain in Primary Total Knee Arthroplasty. This randomized controlled trial asked whether lateralizing the distal limb of the standard midline total knee arthroplasty incision by 3 centimeters, creating a J-shaped incision, reduces peri-incisional numbness versus standard midline incision in patients with Kellgren-Lawrence grade 4 osteoarthritis. Numbness area was mapped with 10 gram SEMS-Weinstein monofilaments at 2 and 6 months. The J-shaped group had significantly smaller sensory deficit areas at both time points and lower visual analog scale pain at 6 months, with equivalent functional scores and complication rates. One limitation to note is that the 6-month follow-up is insufficient to determine whether numbness differences persist or resolve with natural nerve regeneration. Overall, a J-shaped incision with the distal limb lateralized 3 cm at the tibial tuberosity reduced anterior knee numbness area by 54% at 2 months and 60% at 6 months compared to standard midline incision in primary total knee arthroplasty. Moving on, Hattis and colleagues published in Spine Journal, titled Quantifying Postural Recovery After Lumbar Decompression, Cone of Economy Biomarkers of Balance, Effort, and Stability in Patients with Radiculopathy and Neurogenic Claudication. This study asked whether high-resolution three-dimensional motion capture cone of economy metrics could objectively quantify postural recovery after lumbar decompression for stenosis. 36 patients underwent standardized balance assessment 1 week preoperatively and 3 months postoperatively using a 41-marker system synchronized to dual force plates. Medial lateral center of pressure sway, head coronal sway, center of mass sway, total head sway path area, and compensatory cervical, pelvic, and hip kinematics all improved significantly. Oswestry Disability Index improved by 16.8 points, and Tampa Scale of Kinesiophobia decreased by 7.1 points. One limitation to note is that 3-month follow-up is insufficient to determine whether postural improvements are durable, or whether patients with residual sway deficits are at elevated long-term fall risk. Overall, lumbar decompression reduced medial lateral center of pressure sway by 24% and improved Oswestry Disability Index by 16.8 points at 3 months, with cone of economy metrics capturing postural recovery not reflected by patient-reported outcome measures alone. Moving on, Lee and colleagues published in International Orthopedics titled Efficacy of Scapular-Focused Rehabilitation Protocol on Shoulder Function Following Proximal Humeral Internal Locking System Fixation for Proximal Humeral Fractures, a Randomized Controlled Trial. This single-center randomized controlled trial asked whether adding systematic scapular stabilization exercises to standard glenohumeral-centric rehabilitation improves outcomes after PHILOS fixation for 2- and 3-part proximal humeral fractures. 60 patients were randomized 1-to-1 to scapular-focused rehabilitation or standard rehabilitation, with supervised physiotherapy twice weekly for 12 weeks. Scapular-focused rehabilitation produced significantly better constant Burley scores, disabilities of the arm, shoulder, and hand scores, American shoulder and elbow surgeon scores, shoulder pain and disability index scores, visual analog scale pain, and EQ5D quality of life scores at 1 and 3 months. However, all functional differences resolved by 12 months, with no radiographic differences in neck shaft angle or humeral head height at any time point. One limitation to note is that the absence of a blinded assessor introduces performance and detection bias that may inflate early between group differences. Overall, scapular-focused rehabilitation after PHILOS fixation improved constant Murley scores at 1 month and 3 months, but showed no difference at 12 months. Moving on, Luck and colleagues published in Journal of Pediatric Orthopedics, titled Higher Child Opportunity Index is Associated with Supracondylar Humerus Fracture Rates in the Pediatric Population. This study examined whether child opportunity index level predicted surgically treated supracondylar humerus fracture rates at a single level 1 pediatric trauma center from 2010 to 2022 using zip code assigned child opportunity index quintiles. Each child opportunity index quintile increase conferred a 9% greater fracture risk persisting after racial adjustment. Black patients in high child opportunity index areas showed higher rates than white patients. Obesity was independently associated with open reduction in both the general and metropolitan samples, and white and Hispanic patients were more likely to undergo open reduction than other groups. One limitation to note is that capture is limited to surgically managed fractures at one institution, excluding non-operative cases and patients who sought care elsewhere. Overall, each increase in child opportunity index quintile was associated with a 9% higher risk of surgically treated supracondylar humerus fracture, with Black patients in high child opportunity index neighborhoods bearing disproportionately elevated rates. Akimoto and colleagues published in Journal of Shoulder and Elbow Surgery, titled Incidence of Lower Extremity Deep Vein Thrombosis Following Arthroscopic Rotator Cuff Repair. This prospective study screened 209 patients undergoing arthroscopic rotator cuff repair with serial lower extremity ultrasonography on postoperative days 3, 7, and 10 to determine deep vein thrombosis incidence and identify risk factors. Deep vein thrombosis was detected in 11 patients, 5.3%, all asymptomatic peripheral or distal thrombi. D-dimer greater than 3.9 micrograms per milliliter on postoperative day 7 yielded an area under the curve of 0.82 for deep vein thrombosis prediction. Multivariate logistic regression identified age 65 years or older and female sex as independent risk factors, with odds ratios of 8.7 and 6.0 respectively. One limitation to note is that screening terminated at postoperative day 10 with no follow-up ultrasonography, leaving the natural history of detected distal DVTs completely uncharacterized. Overall, lower extremity deep vein thrombosis occurred in 5.3% of patients after arthroscopic rotator cuff repair, all asymptomatic and distal, with age 65 years or older and female sex as independent risk factors. Moving on, Shinoy and colleagues published in Journal of Pediatric Orthopedics, titled Outcomes from a Health-Related Social Needs Screening Initiative in Pediatric Orthopedic Patients, a Prospective Study. This prospective quality improvement study evaluated whether a systematic health-related social needs screening protocol derived from the Accountable Health Communities tool could increase social needs identification and resource enrollment in a tertiary pediatric orthopedic clinic. Post-initiative screening rates rose from 38% to 65%, with 21% of screened patients positive for at least one need. Financial hardship was identified in 13% and food insecurity in 11%. Medicaid insurance was the strongest predictor of social need, and successful service enrollment increased from 25% to 61%. One limitation to note is that the pre-initiative comparison period was only 3 months versus 9 months post-initiative, making it impossible to exclude seasonal variation or secular trends. Overall, a systematic health-related social needs screening initiative in a pediatric orthopedic clinic increased screening completion from 38% to 65%, and successful enrollment in social services from 25% to 61%. Moving on, Bernstein and colleagues published in Clinical Orthopedics and Related Research titled, "Are Age-Based Cutoffs for Total Hip Arthroplasty Logically Consistent?" This decision analysis study used a state transition Markov model to quantify lifetime total hip arthroplasty benefit, measured in joint-adjusted life years as a function of patient age, testing whether age-based hesitancy to operate on young patients is logically consistent with routine total hip arthroplasty use in 85-year-olds. Base case parameters included 15-year prosthetic life expectancy, 90% satisfaction fraction, and 0.5% annual catastrophic failure rate. A 45-year-old male earns 25 joint-adjusted life years at a 5 joint-adjusted life year revision penalty, and lifetime benefit remains above the 6 joint-adjusted life year benchmark unless the revision penalty exceeds 25 joint-adjusted life years. One limitation to note is that the 6 joint-adjusted life year benchmark anchored to 85-year-old patients assumes equivalent procedural acceptability across age groups, but does not account for the qualitatively different risk profile in elderly patients. Overall, a 45-year-old male undergoing total hip arthroplasty accrues 25 lifetime joint-adjusted life years under base case assumptions, and this benefit does not fall below the 6 joint-adjusted life year benchmark set by 85-year-old patients unless the revision penalty exceeds 25 joint-adjusted life years. Sugiyama and colleagues published in Journal of Pediatric Orthopedics titled "Characteristics of Hip Dysplasia in Adults with Cerebral Palsy." This retrospective study quantified hip dysplasia prevalence and severity in adults with cerebral palsy aged 18 years or older using migration percentage and the Melbourne Cerebral Palsy Hip Classification System across 331 patients stratified by gross motor function classification system level. Gross motor function classification system levels 4 and 5 were the strongest predictors of displacement, but gross motor function classification system levels 1 and 2 showed progressive migration percentage increase with age, a finding absent in higher gross motor function classification system groups. The data established that hip dysplasia is not a resolved pediatric problem. 24.5% of the adult cohort had subluxation, and 21.6% of ambulatory adults had severe Melbourne cerebral palsy hip classification system grading. One limitation to note is that cross-sectional design cannot establish whether hip displacement in gross motor function classification system levels 1 and 2 adults is progressive or was present but undetected at skeletal maturity. Overall, in 331 adults with cerebral palsy, 24.5% had hip subluxation with migration percentage greater than 30%. With gross motor function classification system levels 4 and 5 showing the highest displacement, but 21.6% of gross motor function classification system levels 1 and 2 adults were Melbourne cerebral palsy hip classification system grade 4 or higher. Moving on, Kumaran and colleagues published in Journal of Bone and Joint Surgery titled "Stacked Cone Constructs for Extensive Tibial and or Femoral Bone Loss in Complex Primary and Revision Total Knee Arthroplasty," a multicenter analysis of 84 cases. This multicenter retrospective study evaluated 5-year Kaplan-Meier survivorship of stacked metaphyseal cone constructs used for extensive tibial and or femoral bone loss in 84 complex primary or revision total knee arthroplasty cases across 4 tertiary centers. 5-year survivorship free from aseptic loosening was 91.7%, with only one tibial side aseptic loosening failure at 3.6 years. However, all-cause reoperation survivorship was only 56.5%, driven predominantly by periprosthetic joint infection and tibial implant fracture. One limitation to note is that the wide confidence intervals on all Kaplan-Meier estimates reflect insufficient follow-up and event numbers to draw reliable conclusions about true 5-year construct durability. Overall, stacked cone constructs in complex primary and revision total knee arthroplasty achieved 91.7% 5-year survivorship free from aseptic loosening, but only 56.5% survivorship free from all-cause reoperation. Moving on, Schneider and colleagues published in Journal of the American Academy of Orthopedic Surgeons, titled "The Influence of Os Acromyo on Patient Outcomes After Reverse Total Shoulder Arthroplasty, a Matched Cohort Study." This study asked whether os acromyo negatively impacts outcomes after primary reverse total shoulder arthroplasty by comparing 64 shoulders with os acromyo to 320 matched controls from a prospective arthroplasty database. No statistically significant differences were found in any outcome score, including American Shoulder and Elbow Surgeon score, simple shoulder test, constant score, or shoulder pain and disability index, nor in shoulder strength or active range of motion at latest follow-up. Overall complication rates were similar, and no outcome differences were detected between pre-acromion and meso or meta-acromion subtypes. One limitation to note is that the study does not report whether os acromyo fragments were fixed, excised, or left alone intraoperatively. Overall, os acromiale present in 9.7% of cases does not adversely affect functional outcomes or complication rates after reverse total shoulder arthroplasty, with no significant differences in any American Shoulder and Elbow Surgeons simple shoulder test, constant, or range of motion measure versus matched controls at minimum 2-year follow-up. Moving on, Prunesky and colleagues published in American Journal of Sports Medicine titled "Short-Term Patient-Reported Outcomes After Primary Anterior Cruciate Ligament Reconstruction with and without Lateral Extra-Articular Tenodesis, a Matched Cohort Analysis from the Swedish Knee Ligament Registry." This matched cohort registry study compared patient-reported outcomes and revision rates between primary anterior cruciate ligament reconstruction with and without lateral extra-articular tenodesis using 1-4 propensity matching on age, sex, body mass index, graft type, injury to surgery interval, and concomitant pathology. Knee injury and osteoarthritis outcome score subscale 4 scores at 1 and 2 years were statistically and clinically equivalent between groups. Revision anterior cruciate ligament reconstruction rates at 2 years were similar at 2.3% versus 2.4%, and clinical failure rates were 25.5% versus 25.6%. One limitation to note is that the 2-year follow-up window is insufficient to detect divergence in outcomes driven by graft protection, as re-rupture typically manifests beyond 2 years. Overall, adding lateral extra-articular tenodesis to primary anterior cruciate ligament reconstruction produced no difference in knee injury and osteoarthritis outcome score, subscale 4 scores at 1 or 2 years, and identical 2-year clinical failure rates. Moving on, Spahi and colleagues published in Journal of the American Academy of Orthopedic Surgeons, titled "Frailty is a Vital Tool for Predicting Outcomes Following Prophylactic Femur Fixation." This study used the American College of Surgeons National Surgical Quality Improvement Program database from 2015 to 2020 to evaluate whether preoperative frailty, measured by the Rockwood Frailty Index Revised and Modified Frailty Index 5, predicts 30-day adverse outcomes in patients undergoing prophylactic versus pathologic femoral fixation for metastatic disease. After propensity score matching on age, body mass index, sex, functional status, and American Society of Anesthesiologists class, pathologic fracture fixation carried 2.79 times higher 30-day mortality odds versus prophylactic fixation. The Rockwood Frailty Index Revised demonstrated superior mortality discrimination compared to the Modified Frailty Index 5. And each 1-point Rockwood Frailty Index Revised increase corresponded to a 5% incremental mortality risk increase. One limitation to note is that the database does not capture tumor type, Morel score, implant construct, adjuvant radiation, or systemic oncologic therapy, making it impossible to control for disease-specific variables. Overall, each 1-point increase in Rockwood Frailty Index Revised independently raised 30-day mortality odds by 5%, and Rockwood Frailty Index Revised outperformed Modified Frailty Index 5 for mortality discrimination in patients undergoing prophylactic femoral fixation for metastatic disease. Moving on, Ehlers and colleagues published in American Journal of Sports Medicine, titled Knee Synovial Fluid Biomarker Type and Concentration with Long-Term Outcomes After Anterior Cruciate Ligament Reconstruction with Concomitant Meniscal Injury. This study characterized synovial fluid inflammatory phenotypes via K-means clustering of 10 biomarkers aspirated at the time of anterior cruciate ligament reconstruction with concomitant meniscal injury, then correlated phenotype with patient-reported outcome measures at mean 8.2 years. High inflammation patients had significantly worse baseline pain and function, but achieved greater visual analog scale pain improvement and Lysholm improvement than low inflammation patients. Final postoperative patient-reported outcome measures converged between groups, but monocyte chemoattractant protein 1 demonstrated phenotype-dependent associations with outcomes. Minimum clinically important difference achievement for visual analog scale pain was significantly higher in the high inflammation cluster at 57.6% versus 17.6%. One limitation to note is that the two-cluster solution derived from K-means clustering in a single-center cohort of 97 patients has not been validated externally. Overall, at mean 8.2-year follow-up after anterior cruciate ligament reconstruction with concomitant meniscal injury, high inflammation phenotype patients achieved minimum clinically important difference for visual analog scale pain at nearly 3.3 times the rate of low inflammation patients, despite similar final patient-reported outcome measure scores between groups. Moving on, Gieskens and colleagues published in Arthroscopy, titled Female Patients Exhibit a Narrower Glenoid Rim and Lower Bone Density in the Anteroinferior Quadrant Compared with Male Patients. This retrospective single-institution study evaluated sex-based differences in glenoid rim morphology via MRI in 204 patients from instability and uninjured cohorts, and bone density via CT Hounsfield units in 102 uninjured subjects. Female patients demonstrated a significantly narrower glenoid neck-to-face ratio in both instability and uninjured cohorts, with no difference between instability and uninjured subjects of the same sex. Anteroinferior quadrant bone density was 11.7% lower in females at 272.5 versus 303.0 Hounsfield units, while mid-anterior density showed no sex-based difference. One limitation to note is that the bone density analysis was performed exclusively in uninjured subjects. So whether instability-related bone loss further compounds the sex-based deficit remains unknown. Overall, female patients have a significantly narrower glenoid rim and lower anteroinferior quadrant bone density compared to males, independent of instability status. Moving on, Birkenes and colleagues published an American Journal of Sports Medicine titled Risk of Revision and Patient-Reported Outcomes After Anterior Cruciate Ligament Reconstruction, Influence of Concomitant Medial Collateral Ligament Injury, and Graft Choice. Analysis of 35,139 reconstructions from the Norwegian Knee Ligament Register. Using the Norwegian Knee Ligament Register from 2004 to 2024, this study compared revision risk and two-year knee injury and osteoarthritis outcome score outcomes between isolated anterior cruciate ligament reconstruction and anterior cruciate ligament reconstruction with concomitant medial collateral ligament injury. Stratified by medial collateral ligament treatment strategy and anterior cruciate ligament graft type. Concomitant medial collateral ligament injury did not increase overall revision risk, but was associated with 2-point lower knee injury and osteoarthritis outcome score, sport and recreation subscale scores, and lower odds of achieving pass for sport and recreation at 2 years. Within the anterior cruciate ligament plus medial collateral ligament subgroup, hamstring and quadriceps autografts carried significantly higher revision risk than bone patellar tendon bone, with the hamstring plus non-operative medial collateral ligament combination showing a hazard ratio of 2.4. One limitation to note is that medial collateral ligament injury severity grading is absent from the registry, introducing unmeasured confounding because surgeons likely selected operative medial collateral ligament repair for higher grade injuries. Overall, in anterior cruciate ligament reconstruction with concomitant non-operatively treated medial collateral ligament injury, hamstring autograft carries a 2.4 times higher revision risk compared to bone patellar tendon bone autograft across 35,139 reconstructions. Kabarkas and colleagues published in Arthroscopy, titled Prior Hip Arthroscopy is Associated with Inferior Outcomes After Total Hip Arthroplasty, a propensity-matched study. This propensity-matched retrospective cohort study compared patient-reported outcomes and reoperation rates in patients undergoing total hip arthroplasty after prior labral repair arthroscopy versus primary total hip arthroplasty controls matched 1-4 by age, sex, body mass index, approach, and surgery year. Both groups achieved significant postoperative patient-reported outcome improvements, but hip arthroscopy total hip arthroplasty patients scored significantly lower on forgotten joint score, modified Harris hip score, hip outcome score pain subscale, and visual analog scale pain. Only 75.7% of hip arthroscopy total hip arthroplasty versus 87.5% of primary total hip arthroplasty patients achieved the cohort-specific modified Harris hip score minimum clinically important difference of 9.6 points, and all-cause reoperation was fivefold higher in the hip arthroscopy total hip arthroplasty group at 10% versus 2%. One limitation to note is that tennis grading at the time of total hip arthroplasty was not stratified by interval from arthroscopy to total hip arthroplasty, so the contribution of disease progression timing versus arthroscopy-related tissue alteration cannot be separated. Overall, total hip arthroplasty after prior hip arthroscopy yields significantly lower forgotten joint score, modified Harris hip score, and hip outcome score pain scores at mean 6.6 years versus matched primary total hip arthroplasty controls, with a 10% versus 2% all-cause reoperation rate. Moving on. McCormick and colleagues published in Journal of Orthopedic Surgery and Research, titled, Is the Incidence of Conversion from Unicompartmental to Total Knee Arthroplasty Higher Among Surgeons Who Do Not Have Arthroplasty Fellowship Training? This single-institution retrospective study compared two-year unicompartmental knee arthroplasty to total knee arthroplasty conversion rates between arthroplasty fellowship-trained and non-fellowship-trained surgeons performing primary unicompartmental knee arthroplasty from 2010 to 2023. Arthroplasty-trained surgeons had a 2.5% conversion rate versus 5.7% for non-trained surgeons, despite their cohort being older, with higher Charlson comorbidity index scores and lower robotic utilization. Lateral unicompartmental knee arthroplasty demonstrated significantly worse survivorship than medial unicompartmental knee arthroplasty across both groups, and overall complication rates did not differ. One limitation to note is that the absence of multivariable regression controlling for patient age, comorbidity, implant type, and robotic use prevents attribution of the conversion rate difference to fellowship training itself rather than confounding case mix or technology factors. Overall, arthroplasty fellowship-trained surgeons achieved a 2.5% two-year unicompartmental knee arthroplasty to total knee arthroplasty conversion rate versus 5.7% for non-fellowship-trained surgeons, despite operating on older, more comorbid patients with less robotic assistance. Moving on, Bianchi and colleagues published in Journal of Pediatric Orthopedics, titled Clinical Research Article, Surgical Reconstruction of the Proximal Tibia in Primary Bone Tumors in Children and Adolescent Patients, a 30-year retrospective study of osteoarticular and resurfaced allografts. This study evaluated osteoarticular versus resurfaced osteoarticular allograft reconstruction for pediatric proximal tibial primary bone tumors over 30 years. Overall complication rate was 57%, with allograft fracture and pseudoarthrosis predominating. Overall allograft survival was 56% at 5 years and 48% at 10 years, with 67% of patients alive and disease-free at final follow-up. One limitation to note is that the non-concurrent unequal comparison groups make it impossible to isolate technique effect from improvements in chemotherapy, surgical technique, and perioperative care over 3 decades. Overall, resurfaced osteoarticular allograft achieved 58% 5-year allograft survival versus 19% for osteoarticular allograft in pediatric proximal tibial tumor reconstruction, though the difference did not reach statistical significance. Moving on. Hio and colleagues published in Journal of Orthopedic Surgery and Research, titled Rising Volume of Periprosthetic Fractures After Primary Total Hip and Knee Arthroplasty, a Contemporary Epidemiologic Analysis. This study queried three national databases to characterize emergency department visits and surgical volumes for periprosthetic hip and knee fractures from 2017 to 2022, excluding periprosthetic joint infection cases. Of 223,456 emergency department presentations, 155,335 underwent operative management. Linear and Poisson regression modeling projects annual emergency department visits to reach 53,128 for hip and 108,301 for knee by 2035, with per-case hospital costs rising to $81,194 and charges exceeding $300,000 for complex procedures. One limitation to note is that absence of fracture classification, implant stability data, and patient comorbidity indices prevents any analysis of outcomes, revision rates, or identification of modifiable risk factors. Overall, between 2017 and 2022, 224,456 emergency department visits occurred for periprosthetic hip and knee fractures, with annual surgical volumes projected to reach up to 31,400 knee and 29,017 hip procedures by 2035 at costs up to $81,194 per case. Moving on, Kurtz and colleagues published an American Journal of Sports Medicine titled The Effect of Smoking History on Inflammatory Biomarkers in Synovial Fluid of Patients Undergoing Arthroscopic Knee Surgery for Meniscal Injury. This study asked whether tobacco use history alters the intra-articular cytokine environment in symptomatic meniscal tears by prospectively collecting synovial fluid at arthroscopy from 297 patients stratified into current smokers, former smokers, and non-smokers. Analysis of variants identified significant differences in 9 of 10 biomarkers, including monocyte chemoattractant protein 1, matrix metalloproteinase 3, vascular endothelial growth factor, tissue inhibitors of metalloproteinases 1 and 2, interleukin-1 receptor antagonist, and basic fibroblast growth factor. Post-hoc analysis showed former smokers differed from non-smokers across nearly all biomarkers, and linear regression identified a dose-dependent negative association between PAC years and regulated upon activation normal T-cell expressed and secreted in current smokers, and a positive association between cessation duration and interleukin-6 in former smokers. One limitation to note is that the cross-sectional, single-time-point synovial fluid collection cannot establish whether the observed biomarker differences precede meniscal injury, result from it, or reflect chronic smoking-induced joint changes. Overall, in 297 patients undergoing knee arthroscopy for meniscal injury, 9 of 10 synovial fluid biomarkers differed significantly between smoking cohorts, with regulated upon activation normal T-cell expressed and secreted negatively associated with PAC years, and interleukin-6 positively associated with time since cessation. And finally, Culler and colleagues published in Journal of Orthopedic Surgery and Research, titled Reassessing Total Joint Arthroplasty Case Volumes in the United States, Accounting for Ultra-Low Volume Surgeons. This study used a national insurer database to recharacterize total joint arthroplasty surgeon volume trends by separating ultra-low volume surgeons performing fewer than 10 cases per year from standard volume surgeons performing 10 or more cases per year. Ultra-low volume surgeons comprised 57-60% of all total joint arthroplasty surgeons, yet performed only approximately 4% of cases across the study period. When restricted to standard volume surgeons, mean annual caseload rose from 79.1 to 90.7, and the patient-weighted average surgeon volume reached 192.8 cases per year by 2023. One limitation to note is that single-payer database coverage excludes Medicare and Medicaid populations, which represent the majority of total joint arthroplasty volume in the U.S. and likely contain a disproportionate share of low-volume surgeons. Overall, after excluding ultra-low-volume surgeons performing fewer than 10 cases per year, mean annual total joint arthroplasty volume among standard volume surgeons increased from 79.1 to 90.7 cases between 2016 and 2023. And the typical total joint arthroplasty patient was treated by a surgeon performing approximately 192 cases per year. That wraps up this week's Ortho Digest Rundown. 25 studies reviewed. Head to ortho-digest.com for the full write-ups. Until next week, stay current.